Hello, and welcome to Introducing Me. I'm your host, Sarah. I started this podcast to get to know other people and lifestyles while discovering more about myself. Each episode, I'll give a new guest a chance to discuss their background, culture, interests, or whatever they want to talk about to help increase all of our own worldviews. Today, I would like to introduce you to Jess. Jess has a lot of different stories that she's going to share, so I don't fully know what we're going to talk about entirely, but I will give you the heads up that she lives in Australia. She did not grow up in Australia, but her growing up story from her childhood is not the best, and so she will be talking a little bit about some trauma that she has had. So I wanted to give that warning out before I introduced her, so in case, you know, that is not something you want to listen to, that is completely okay. But we will be starting with some more fun stuff, so I encourage you to stick around at least for the beginning to get to know a little bit about Jess. So Jess, thank you so much for being here. Why don't you say hello and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, first, thank you so much for having me on your show. So as you said, I'm Jess. I am 25 years old. I had to pause and think. I'm getting that old. I currently live in Australia, but I was born in Belgium, which is a tiny country in Europe, and I've lived all over Europe. I am engaged to my partner, Ben. We have a 7-month-old baby girl together called Rowena, and we have a dog called Nanny. And yeah, that's pretty much kind of me in a little bubble.
Well, why don't we talk a little bit about the end of what you just said, your dog and your baby, which came first?
So the dog came first. I've grown up with dogs my entire life. I first got a puppy who was my own puppy when I was 2. I got to name her. I had to train her, though I was 2, so she wasn't very well trained. So I've always had dogs. And when Ben and I moved in together initially, we were living in a place that didn't allow pets. And I kept telling him, the minute we can have pets, we're getting a pet. And Ben was terrified of dogs, which kind of created an issue because there was no way I was not having a dog and there was no way he was having a dog. At that time, I was working as a dog trainer, and so I would take him with me to lessons and take him with me when I was dog sitting so he could like start to see the dogs aren't terrifying animals. And he completely fell in love with dogs. There was a few dogs along that journey that made him completely fall in love with the idea of having a dog. And so then we moved to Australia. I'm kind of jumping around here, but we moved to Australia and we got a dog within a week of moving to Australia, which was chaos. I would not recommend that. But yeah, so we got our dog 3 years ago. We got her on the 23rd of December. She was not a Christmas present. It's just how dates lined up. So yeah, she's a little Italian greyhound. So she's like a racing greyhound shape, but she's teeny tiny. She's really very small. She weighs like 10 pounds, I think. So she's minuscule. I love her so much. And then yeah, we had the baby like 2.5 years later.
Cool. That's, you always hear a lot about people getting the dogs and then having the babies. But I also think it's great that you're like, yeah, he'll never have a dog. And but no, we have a dog.
Yep. I forced him. No, I didn't. I always let him make the decision because obviously growing up, like he was legit scared of dogs. One day we went to my grandparents' house and they'd just gotten a little Shih Tzu puppy. So like a small, like tiny little ball of fluff. And he was terrified of her. And I was like, she can't do anything. She is smaller than a soccer ball. She cannot hurt you. And he was terrified. And it was, for me, it was a big deal because I'd grown up with dogs and I've always wanted multiple dogs at home. So it was a few years of getting him more used to dogs. But now he absolutely adores Nanny. I mean, as you saw just before we started recording, he was carrying her to bed. And that's every night he picks her up and carries her into our bed. Like she is completely his biggest baby. And she was definitely the first baby of the house. We babied her a lot when we first got her.
Yeah, that's really cute. Now, did babying the dog, did that help when you first had Rowena?
There's a lot of similarities between puppies and babies. So puppies wake up in the night. Puppies need to be taught where to pee. Puppies go through teething phases. You have to teach them right from wrong. So we naively thought, oh, it's fine. It's like a baby. It's not. Puppies wake up like twice in the night. Babies wake up every hour. It's a very different situation. But there was having a dog, and especially the training I use is called positive reinforcement. So it's all about like using positive stuff. So it's, you don't punish the dog. You try and show them the good thing instead. So you're always leading them to success. And it's very similar to the kind of parenting technique that Ben and I have always kind of said, when we have kids, this is how we'd want to parent. So in that sense, we already had a dynamic between us of, you know, sometimes you'll lose your temper, especially with like lack of sleep. And I'll notice the signs in him if he's starting to lose his temper, or he'll notice the signs in me. And that was thanks to having the experience with the puppy and being able to be like, you know what, I'm just going to take the baby for a minute and you just go cool off. So in that sense, having a dog first did help learn how to have a baby. But at the same time, they are not the same thing. Like if you have a puppy, don't think that's what's going to be like when you have a baby, because it's not the same.
Yeah, definitely some good advice there. Now, I think that we have been talking for a while now, so I'm kind of like, what was said after we hit record? But I think you mentioned that you are engaged. So how was, I don't know if this is like too personal, but was...
No, go for it.
Was Rowena planned? Because obviously, like, I'm assuming engaged with the intent to eventually get married. Mm-hmm. Has there been any struggle there?
So with talking of getting married, we had a small, like, informal ceremony, I'll say. It's not, like, there was no officiant or anything. There was no religious or legal basis to it. It was just, we had a few friends meet us kind of in a park. And this was just before we left Belgium to move to Australia, because we knew, were we to get married out in Australia, most of our friends wouldn't be able to afford to fly out. So we consider ourselves married. We call each other husband and wife, which makes it very complicated when you're filling out legal forms, because you have to remember you're not actually legally married. So for us, we are already married. And the discussion of babies has always kind of been there. Even though we got together very young, we were 16 when we started dating, we've both always known we wanted kids. And we were 22, I want to say, when we started talking about it. And he was adamantly, it's not happening. And not happening in time, at least 26. I want to be done with university. And I was kind of on the opposite side. I was like, no, but like, I'm ready to kind of start trying now. And then about a year later, he suddenly changed his mind. I was like, you know what? Let's start trying. Let's have a baby. It doesn't matter if I'm university. Let's get this done. It took us 11 months to conceive. So that's quite a long time for a young couple. Like younger couples with no health issues should only take about 6 months. So that really affected my mental health and I spiraled completely out of control after a while. But no, she was definitely very much planned, very much wanted. So just took her time to get here, but she was wanted.
Yes, and now you shared some exciting news about her before we started recording. So do you want to share that news here?
Yes, she said her first word. She said mama in context, looking at me. It wasn't just random, because she's been doing the random mama for days now. And every time she does that, I look at Ben and be like, she's saying mama. And he's like, no, she's not. She's just making sounds. But then today she looked me dead in the eye and said mama, and then throughout the day she'd reach for me and say mama. So she's talking. She said a word. She's not quite talking.
Well, it's my understanding, with very limited experience around babies, that once they start, they don't stop.
Yep, that's pretty accurate. So we're getting there.
Well, that's exciting that you're hitting some new milestones, because they'll go by quickly.
Yeah, for sure.
So do you want to kind of switch gears and talk a little bit about where you've lived? And, you know, so you've been in Australia for a couple years. Where else have you lived? And just kind of take us through that little process.
Sure. So I was born in Belgium, which, as I said, is a very small country in Europe. It's near France and Germany. Those are kind of like the two big countries people know of in Europe. So I was born in Belgium and I lived there till I was 8. And then my parents divorced when I was 18 months old, and my mom had custody of me. And when I was 8, we then moved to Monaco, which is an even smaller country in Europe. Most people know it because of the Formula One race that's there every year. Basically, Monaco is like in the south of France, very near Italy. And we lived there for 9 or 10 months, and then we moved near London in the UK, and we lived there for like a year and a bit. And then we moved back to Belgium, and we stayed there until I finished high school. And then I alone moved to the Seychelles for 6 months. So Seychelles is a group of islands off of the coast of Africa. Basically, if you take Madagascar and you take Kenya and you draw two lines, where those two lines will meet is a tiny group of islands called the Seychelles, and I lived there. And I lived, I guess you could say, in Mexico for 6 weeks, and then I moved to Australia 3 years ago. So kind of in between the Seychelles and Mexico, I'd always go back to Belgium and live there until like a new adventure called me. So very nomadic.
Yeah, that's definitely a lot of different places. Do you have a favorite?
It depends how you would classify favorite. I'm very sappy, and I'd have to say probably Belgium, in the sense that that's where Ben and I met. And when I lived in the Seychelles and when I lived in Mexico, we were together, but he was living in Belgium. So that was always home base for me, and always like where I wanted to return outside of my sappiness. Probably I would have to say the Seychelles, because it's that very typical idyllic white sandy beach, turquoise waters. I was working at a dive center there because I'm a scuba diving instructor. And it was just a very idyllic life. And a lot of people, you know, talk about like island time and that island lifestyle where nothing's ever running late. It just happens when it happens. And it was such a huge change to living in a pretty big, busy European city. And like in the Seychelles, there's one bus an hour. Whether it gets there on the hour or whether it gets there 15 minutes or half an hour late, you don't know until the bus shows up. And it was learning to just let go and just release. And so for that, I'd probably say living in the Seychelles was my favorite, because it was such a... I lived basically in a holiday resort for 6 months. So that was amazing.
Yeah, that sounds like definitely an experience of a lifetime. And for 6 months, like 6 months is a good bit of time to experience mm-hmm. different things.
Yeah.
So what was the different cultures like? Did you find yourself easily fitting in these different places, or were you completely taken aback and shocked?
Mm-hmm. So obviously Monaco in the UK was so similar to Belgium, and my mom is of Scottish origin. So living in the UK was pretty normal for us. We were going to the UK all the time anyway, so that was nothing. Going to the Seychelles was a really big shock. So I went as part of a volunteer program, I guess you can call it. It's called GVI. They have volunteer programs all over the world based on different things. And so I was part of the scuba diving research team with them. And so how it was split up is it was 3 months living on camp and then 3 months living and working at a dive center. And so what that meant was that I was surrounded by people from all sorts of different cultures and countries. Like there was Americans, Australians, there was other Brits, there was Danish people, Finnish people, Norwegian people, there was Canadians, like there was everybody. And then on our days off, we were encouraged to go into like the local towns and villages and meet like locals. And part of our volunteering program is we worked with the school on the island that we were at, and we taught them once a week. We taught them like lessons about the ocean, and then once a week we also volunteered with the local orphanage. So we would take the kids out and teach them to swim and teach them to be safe in the water and teach them like different fish. So it was really axed on living within the local community. And it was such, like, as I said, because it's like island life and it was completely different, and they speak Creole, but like Seychellois Creole, which is different to like other Creole. So like it was learning a whole new language and a whole new way of life. And where we lived on base, we had technically had electricity and we had running water, but it was cold water, and half of the time the electricity didn't work. So it was also learning to live without all the amendments we have at home. Like I grew up pretty well off, so I always had electricity, I always had hot water, I always had internet at home. And then I was living in a place that did not have internet or even phone reception. We had to use a satellite phone if we needed, like if we had to call someone in an emergency from camp. So that was a huge culture shock, just living in that culture, but also just a shock to like the entire system, because it was a completely different way of life. And then when I lived in Mexico, I lived in a small village called Xcalac, which is in the south. It's about a kilometer away from the border with Belize on the like beach. And that was completely different to anything I'd ever experienced before, because there's 400 people who live there. They're all native Mexicans. I was working at the dive center there. So there was like the group of like, I don't know, 20 white people and then all native Mexicans. And it was a completely different world. And thankfully I'd taken Spanish at school, so I could kind of get by and talk to them. But it was not at all like anything I had experienced before. And I remember the shops, like to go get food in Xcalac. You walk into the shop, and so normally with like our supermarkets or even our small shops, you walk in and there's all like the aisles of food, and you walk up and down and get what you want, and then you go to the counter to pay. In Xcalac, you walk in and there's the counter, and you have to ask the person at the counter to get you eggs or pasta or bread. And I remember walking in and going, I don't remember how to say eggs, and I need to buy eggs, and there's no internet, so I can't Google how to say eggs. So I had to describe like the thing the chicken makes in my really bad Spanish I still had. And I remember it was every day when I'd get to work at the dive center where there was internet, I'd have to Google my shopping list and like Google translate it and write it down on a piece of paper so that I could go buy basic necessities like water or bread or eggs. And that was not something I've ever had to experience before or since. I've never had that happen to me since. But it was realizing how different people live. And I remember one of the people who worked there was saying, why are you so surprised? Like, isn't this how shops are where you're from? And I just looked at him, I said, not at all. Like, where I'm from, we just walk in, we get what we need, and we walk out. And he said, well, that's so impersonal. Here you can chat with me and we can have a conversation and you can get to know me. And I realized just how different my life was to these people. Whether you think it's good or bad, it was such a huge culture shock once again.
Yeah, that's definitely different than anything I've heard. The only experience that I've had similar to that in the shops, I was not expecting that that is what you were going to describe. There was a shop when I did my semester abroad in London. I believe it was called Argos, which was like a big chain. And it was like you went in and there was a counter and they had kiosks where you could like look up what you wanted, and then I feel like you got like a code or something, and you were like, the code, this is what I want, and then they'd like, I don't know, go into this big warehouse and pull out whatever you wanted. But it wasn't groceries, like,
yeah,
you know, I think about the long lists that I make when I go grocery shopping, that I'm like, I would be going to the grocery store every day to just get like short lists. But if it's personal, like, that's the goal.
Yeah. And it was amazing because I got to learn so much about like Xcalac and the history of the city, like the village, and learning about the people who lived there. And I only lived there for 6 weeks, but I do consider that I lived there. Like, I knew so many people in the village, and I was genuinely sad, and I was losing friends when I left. So it was such a completely different experience for sure.
Yeah. Did you plan to stay there for longer than 6 weeks, or was that your like allotted time?
So that was kind of my allotted time. So I was again with GVI, that company, but this was a completely different thing. I wasn't doing research. It was actually my training to become a diving instructor. So how it works often in diving is you get your training and in exchange you work for them. So there's no payment or anything. So you don't get paid for work, but you don't have to pay them to get trained, because training in diving is very, very expensive. It can be several thousands of dollars for like a 2-day course. So how it worked here is I was housed for free. Well, for free. I was housed and I was trained to be a scuba diving instructor and a first aid instructor. But in exchange, I worked for them for 6 weeks, because that kind of covered all my costs. So that's why after the 6 weeks, I came home, because like that was kind of the end of the contract we had agreed on, kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. I wasn't sure, because like you said, how like you were losing friends. So it's like you were going into it knowing, I'm only here for 6 weeks. This is all I get.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you mentioned a little bit, especially there, about the language barrier. Do you know other languages? Have you had language barriers in other places?
So because I'm born in Belgium, I'm fluent in French. My dad is actually French and my partner's French. So I'm fluent English, French, and have been basically since birth. And I speak Spanish much more now since I lived in Mexico than before. I used to speak a bit of Flemish, which is a variant of Dutch that's spoken in Belgium. I technically speak what's called Bruxellois, which is like the Brussels dialect from Belgium. Other than that, I don't speak any other languages. I've definitely experienced a lot of language barriers. My parents, as I said, were separated, but both have always really pushed learning about different cultures and traveling. So I've been really, really very fortunate that I've seen a lot of countries around the world. But with that comes language barriers. So like I've been to Thailand and Morocco, and both my parents are always very adamant, you don't do tourist stuff when you're in a country. You actually see the country for what it is. So like I've found myself in Thailand with my mom and we didn't know where we were and we couldn't speak to people and ask them like where we were and how do we get back to where we need to be. So that's an experience trying to like mime things and like trying to get through, but we've always managed. I've never had issues to that extent. Like we've always found a way around language barriers, but it's definitely something I've experienced a few times.
Yeah, I love the mindset of experience the actual culture, don't do the touristy things. Mm-hmm. I always try to like hit up at least one touristy things because like, mm-hmm. You can't like go to Paris and not see the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, it's just there. But to do mm-hmm. everything else is really mm-hmm. cool.
Yeah.
You said that your partner is French. As well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So do you speak French in the house or do you go all English?
So we used to speak French and then we decided to move to Australia. And so a bit of a backstory about languages. Ben and I met in high school. We went to what's called the European School. They're all over Europe. They're four kids whose parents work in the European Commission. It's kind of an like elite private school. Everybody leaves the school with at least three languages under their belts. I've got friends who can speak seven languages, having learned at school. So he took English as a second language at school because he was in the French language section. So he spoke English, but when we decided to move to Australia, his English wasn't where he wanted it to be to live permanently in an English country. So then we switched to speaking in English at home. That was probably about 4 years ago. And now we speak in English at home, but sometimes we'll have moments where we just flick into French. So if we're having a conversation and one of us forgets a word in English and then says it in French, the rest of the conversation will continue into French and then it'll flip back into English and then back into French. And then he also took Spanish at school, so sometimes we'll flick into Spanish instead. And we tend to speak English. Like I'd say 95% of the time we'll speak in English at home, but then French and vaguely sometimes Spanish will jump into there too.
That's a lot of fun. Now, what is the plan with your daughter? Are you going to attempt to teach her multiple languages?
So I mentioned I was born to a bilingual couple. And so what we're doing with our daughter is what my parents did with me. So I speak to her solely in English. Ben speaks to her solely in French. And then at home, we speak in English. And then sometimes we'll flick into French. I do try and teach her French stuff, though, when I'm with her, especially if I have her for like a day, I'll still like teach her things, especially. So she's 7 months old. So she's really starting to learn the names of things, like the names of colors. So I'll tell her like that block is red. And then I'll say the same sentence in French. And then I'll flick back into English and back into French. So I'll repeat the same sentence maybe four times, twice in English, twice in French, so that she can start kind of assimilating these words mean the same thing in this language and in this language. Because our goal is for her to be bilingual, because obviously half her family is French. Even though she was born in Australia and will at least grow up in Australia, I don't know what she'll choose to do when she's an adult, but her paternal grandparents are French and speak very little English. So she has to be able to speak French. She can't not speak half of her language. And it's also half her culture. So it's very important for us that we do teach her French. Her main language will likely be English because her schooling will be in English and that kind of stuff. But we want that at home she does see kind of 50-50 English and French.
That, to me, that is fascinating, how it really works. And they say in general, and this might be very more American, that like young children, like if you're an all English speaking household, but if they start to learn Spanish, because that tends to be like our main second language, mm-hmm. if they learn it young, they grasp it so much better. Mm-hmm. So that was really interesting to hear how that is going to work. And it makes total sense that if Ben's parents do not speak a lot of English, that like obviously she needs to know French.
Yeah. It's quite funny though, because especially if I speak to her in French, she'll like look at me like, whoa, what are you doing? That is confusing. And then you can see her brain almost clicks into like French mode and then she's completely fine. And then if I flip back into English, she gets confused again for a minute. And I know for my parents, I was the same. And when I started talking, I would mix English and French together. So I would make up words. There was like a mixture of the word in English and the word in French. And that took a few years to get out of my system. And that's true of all like born bilingual kids, is there's a moment where their brain doesn't realize it's two languages. In their heads, it's just one language where you can say things multiple ways. So that's going to be fun with her when she's going to start doing that. Like, that's something I'm kind of looking forward to, in the sense of like, it's just going to be funny seeing what kind of words she makes up.
Right. But I mean, you have the experience that you went through it. So I mm-hmm. think that'll help, that you won't have, I would hope, you won't have the like frustrating moments that someone mm-hmm. who didn't experience that might then experience, if that is their goal. And you also have the benefit that like your family is bilingual because of mm-hmm. your backgrounds. It's not purely just because you learned another. Like if you were to throw in Spanish into the mix, it's neither mm-hmm. of yours primary language.
Yeah, exactly. And we're not just teaching her that language. As I said, we're teaching her that culture, because it is who she is. So it's not just, hey, these are words that are important for you to know. It's like the meaning behind the words and cultural aspects of the language are important too.
Right. Now, you mentioned that she's going to grow up in Australia. So you clearly mm-hmm. have the intent to stay in Australia long term.
Yeah. So for now, visa that we're on expires in about 18 months. But at that point, we will be applying for what's called a residency visa. So you have all the same rights as a citizen, except for the right to vote. And your children will not be put as high up on a list of priority for schooling as a citizen's kids. But other than that, you're basically a citizen. And then after that, you can do a citizenship test. So that's kind of our long-term goal. We don't plan on ever leaving Australia. There's no reason for us to leave. We're very happy here. So the goal is for Rowena to grow up here for sure.
Is there ever any concern? I know very little about the visa process. Is there ever any concern that your visa would not be approved for the new type?
So how visas work in Australia is it's on a points system. Especially with the residency and citizenship visas, you have to get, I can't remember how many points. I think it's, say something, it's like 60 points to get a residency visa. Being 25, you get 25 points off the bat. Speaking X level of English, you get another 10 points. Having lived here for a few years, you get 5 points. And so you just have to hit all these criteria. And then once you hit the criteria, you can get the visa. You have to pay, obviously, for the visa, but then you can get the visa. So it's getting to the point where you get enough points. It's quite complicated, but we've lived here for 3 years. Ben has studied here and gotten a degree here, which gives him immediately, I think it's 10 or 20 points. I'd say we're now in that age bracket. If you're between 25 and 35 years old, you immediately get 25 points. If you're under that or over that, you only have 5 points. They really want people to be reproducing here. So we know by the time this visa expires, we'll have enough points to get residency visas. And we have, it doesn't add points, but it does push our case further that we have a child who was born here. That can help you get a visa, because like, it's not fair for her to be ripped away from where she's lived and where she's grown up. And like, she is more likely to want to stay in Australia and therefore to want to have more babies here, because obviously Australia is still very like new country in a lot of ways. I mean, it's a very old country. The white population is very new. That's a very big racial discussion, but the government is trying to keep as many people here as possible to help open up gene pools a lot more. So hence why like that 25 to 35 age range is like really wanted here. And if you're born here, they try and like keep you here, like entice you to stay. So we shouldn't have any issues with getting a visa.
That is so nifty. That is based on coins. And like, then, you know, as you said, like, there aren't surprises because you can literally sit down and say, like, this is how many points I have.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to kind of switch complete gears and go into what I mentioned at the beginning, that you had trauma growing up. Mm-hmm. Now, I know nothing about this, so I have, like, no basis to start. So would you mind just taking us through your childhood and your experiences?
Sure. So the way I always explain it, kind of the shortest way, and it gives people an idea of where the story goes, is, do you know the Disney movie Tangled, the one about Rapunzel?
Yes.
So Mother Gothel. My mom was very similar to her, only worse. And that tends to give people kind of an idea of where things go. The way I always start the story is when I realized something was wrong. And it was actually watching the movie Tangled. I was about 15 and my best friend kept saying, you have to watch this movie, it's amazing, I'll lend you the DVD. So she lent me the DVD and I sat down and I watched it. And I really enjoyed it, I thought it was a really good movie. And I gave it back to her and I said, I just don't get there's no villain. I don't get it. There's no villain. And she paused and went, yes, there's a villain, Jess, Mother Gothel. I said, Mother Gothel's not a villain. I mean, okay, she kidnapped a baby, but, you know, she was a good mom. And my friend just paused and went, no, she wasn't, Jess. She was horrible. She was manipulative. She was controlling. How do you not see that? And that's when I paused and I went, can I, borrow that DVD again? I just need to watch the movie one more time. And that was my first inkling that the way I was raised wasn't normal. And wasn't healthy. And that was confirmed a few years later when my mom kicked me out of the house for no reason. And I had to move in with my dad. And we were talking one day about my high school. And he was talking about how much he hated my high school. And I said, why did you send me there? Mom told me that you guys agreed on sending me to that school. So if you hated it so much, why did you send me? And he said, I never agreed for you to go to that school. I didn't want you to go to that school. And that kind of opened up this huge packet of all the lies my mom had told me. And so my dad and I went through months and months of every day I'd say, hey, what about this story my mom's told me? And he'd have to correct it and put in the facts. And then I'd reach out to my mom's mother, my grandmother, and I did the same thing for a few months, and then reached out to one of my aunts and did the same thing. And that's when I realized nothing of what I was told growing up was true. And I was raised to be my mother's savior, my mother's protector, but also her precious jewel, if that makes sense. So my parents divorced when I was 18 months old. And that's when the abusive behavior really started properly. There was already aspects of it before. It kind of is what led to their divorce. My mom was abusive towards my father. The way they divorced is one day my dad came home and his wife and baby were not there. He didn't know where we were. He didn't know where we were for 4 days until he finally managed to track us down, which obviously was traumatic for him. At that point, I was sent to see a child psychiatrist because I would scream if my mom came near me. Obviously, I'm 18 months old. That's not normal. The child psychiatrist determined that I was at risk for depression and anxiety, and my mom had to change her behavior severely. But I was born in the 90s in Belgium, and at that point, legally, if a couple divorced, mom got custody unless dad fought for it. And my dad is always of the opinion you don't separate a child from their mother. Sorry. So he didn't fight for me in court, which means my mom got full custody of me. So the type of abuse I underwent was very much manipulative, was very much, she would tell me, your dad doesn't like you. So my dad got remarried and they had a child together when I was 6. And, you know, my mom told me, oh, by the way, your dad called. He doesn't want to see you anymore. They have a baby together now. They don't need you. And it was that kind of constantly, this whole, you're not loved. Nobody loves you but me. My aunt got married and I was supposed to be, she had always told me I'd be a bridesmaid at her wedding. And so when she got engaged, I was really excited. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be a bridesmaid. I was 13. So it was this huge deal in my head. And my mom said, oh, she doesn't want you there. You're not allowed to be a bridesmaid. I only found out years later that she did want me there. She didn't want my mom there. For obvious reasons, my mom's not a great person, if you haven't caught on already. So it was a lot of that kind of mental nobody loves you but me idea, which is where, like, I compare to Mother Gothel, you know, where Mother Gothel's always saying, like, you can't leave your tower because you're not safe outside your tower. You have to stay with me. And that's very much how I grew up. There was some physical abuse. She would drag me around by my hair, or I used to wear like a gold bangle that she would like hook her finger in to drag me around, because gold digging into your skin really hurts. But I talk about my abuse pretty openly because no one at school knew that I was being abused. My best friend that I've known since I was three had no idea I was being abused, because we always think child abuse is kids who are being like touched inappropriately, or kids who come into school with weird bruises or bumps or weird broken bones they can't explain away. And that was never my case. I never had any physical marks of any of the abuse, but there's mental scars that now will never go away. And for people to hear that child abuse can be mental and can be very devastating without your parent ever having to lay a hand on you. Like I say, there were some physical sides to the abuse, but it wasn't nearly as bad as all like the mental stuff. I know, so I have, obviously I have a therapist that I see regularly with everything I went through. And last time I saw her, she said, I have taken into account that you have anxiety and you have depression and you have PTSD and you have panic attacks a couple times a week. Honestly, you are much more stable than I thought you would be considering your case, which was interesting to hear from a professional. It, I think, shows how devastating mental manipulation and emotional abuse can be on a child. Like even now, when I have to talk to my mom, I have to psych myself up for days, like just to send her a text. I have to psych myself up for days and I prepare myself for what she's going to say, because I always know what she's going to say at this point. But it's things like when Ben and I got engaged. So I told her and she was really happy over the moon. We went out, she bought me champagne. It was this whole big thing. And then a week later she said, that was a joke, right? You're not seriously going to marry that idiot. And then a week later, she said, I can't wait for you guys to get married. I can't wait. I've already started looking at Mother of the Bride dresses. And then a week later, when are you dumping him? And it's this constant, you don't know where you stand with her for anything. And so that's been kind of the entirety of my childhood also, is if I say this to my mom, is she going to be happy? Is she going to be sad? Is this going to be a party or am I going to get punished for it? And that's led to a lot of anxiety. Like I can't order food at a restaurant. Because when I was a kid, I'd say, oh, mommy, can I have this? And she'd go, no, you won't like that. You're going to have this instead. And so it's gotten to the point now where I'm scared of ordering by myself because I feel like I'm going to order the wrong dish. And I'm 25 years old and I can't order food by myself. I still, to this day, I'm able to pick my own dish out now, but then I have to ask my partner to order to the waiter for me because I can't do that bit yet by myself. So that's why I do talk about the abuse, because I think a lot of people don't realize that, like, Mother Gothel does exist, and there's a lot of them out there. Through talking about this, I've met a lot of people who have grown up like me and who feel like they can't talk about it because, you know, you say, oh, I was abused as a child, and people go, physically or sexually? You're like, well, mentally. So it's completely different to what people expect.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate you sharing all that. And as you were speaking and I was, you know, absorbing everything and all the little details, I was thinking, oh, like I could ask this or oh, I could ask this. And you covered so much in your word vomit, as I call it. But yes. It's good to hear, you know, obviously, like, you have the therapist, you're able to have those conversations, and to hear that you were so blind to the fact of what was happening, that you did not even realize that Mother Gothel is a bad person in that movie. She is the villain. My boyfriend always jokes with me that I don't like conflict in movies. So, like, I love Tangled, but, like, I hate Mother Gothel. So it was really interesting to hear that side of it.
It was interesting because I avoided that movie for a few years after my mom kicked me out because I was aware that it was going to be too triggering. And then I watched it a couple years ago with my partner. And like, we knew we were going to watch it that day. I was like ready for it. And I was okay for the most part until Mother Gothel's song Mother Knows Best. Everything Mother Gothel says in that song, my mom has and still says to me to this day. Don't go out, you're going to get trampled by a rhino. Okay, my mom would say elephant, not rhino, but like, you're going to get trampled by a big scary animal. Don't go out, there's thieves, ruffians, like all of these things, word for word, is what my mom would say to me. And that song, if I'm not okay, like if I'm not having a mentally amazing day, even just a mediocre day, that song will trigger me completely. So it's crazy to me now watching it. I find Mother Gothel's probably one of the worst Disney villains out there, just because obviously for me, it's such a like triggering aspect. And it's funny to think 10 years ago, sorry, I didn't realize that she was even a villain. I just thought she was a normal mom. So things have changed quite a bit in 10 years.
Yeah. And now we talked a little bit about this beforehand. But how has your relationship with your mother experienced all of that? Transformed you into the mother that you are today?
So I mentioned I always wanted kids, and I didn't realize until I got pregnant what my childhood would mean for me as a parent. I think I was just avoiding that. I was also unpacking a lot of other things about my childhood at that point, so I think it all just kind of came to a head at one point. And when I was pregnant, I realized, like, this isn't just being pregnant, you know, the pregnancy glow and the baby kicks and the presents. This means I'm going to have a kid. And that means I'm going to be a mom. And I started panicking. And so my mom claims her mom was abusive to her. She wasn't, but that's kind of my mom's excuse for her abusive behavior. And in my family, for as far back as we've traced my family on my mom's side, all the girls, you'll have a redhead, and then that redhead will have a brunette, and the brunette will have a redhead, and the redhead will have a brunette. And it's gone back like that. We've traced the family back to the 14th century, and it's always been a redhead has a brunette, has a redhead, has a brunette. And so when I was pregnant, we decided with Ben not to find out the sex of the baby for a few reasons. The main one being we're very much not gender conformity. We don't care for that. And we knew if we found out we were having a girl, everybody was going to buy us pink frilly stuff. And I didn't want a house full of pink frilly things. And if we were going to have a boy, everyone was going to buy us blue dinosaur stuff. And I didn't want a house full of blue dinosaur stuff. So that's the main reason we chose not to find out the sex. I only realized after my daughter was born that there was a subconscious reason on my part that I didn't want to know if I was having a girl, because I didn't think I could parent a girl. I didn't think I could break the chain. So I didn't actually go into labor. I was induced. That's a whole other story. And I ended up with an emergency C-section. And so we're in the OR. And the last thing I'm thinking about is the sex of the baby. Because the reason I needed an emergency C-section is baby's heart rate had started dropping. So a baby's heart rate normally rests around 150 beats per minute. And she was dropping down to 90 beats per minute. So that was like, okay, we need to get the baby out now. So I'm rushed into the OR. They start the operation. We hear baby cry. There's a sigh of relief in the room. Actually, everyone bursts out laughing in the room because at that point, the baby screamed so loudly, it echoed inside the operation room. And then we had asked the midwife that Ben announces the sex of the baby, whether born like naturally or via C-section. Nobody else says it. We wanted Ben to say it. And so one of the nurses picks up the baby and walks the baby over. And my entire pregnancy, I thought I was having a boy. And I think that was projection, that I was scared of having a daughter. And they walk over, and I'm so hyped up on drugs, I can't focus on the baby enough to see if there's a something or if there's no something. And so Ben says, oh, it's a girl. And initially I'm like, oh, a girl. And then part of me just closed up and I started panicking. And I was thinking, oh gosh, I'm having a daughter. That means I'm more likely to replicate my mother. I don't know why I thought that, but I definitely panicked at the idea of having a girl, and how can I break the cycle if it's already biologically repeating itself? And then they cleaned her up and they checked her over. She was completely fine, by the way. Her heart was completely fine. And then they bring her over to me, and the first thing I see is she has bright red hair, and I have bright red hair. And normally, up until the 14th century, I was supposed to have had a brunette child. My mom was a brunette. My grandmother was a redhead. I was a redhead, therefore should have had a brunette. And seeing that she had red hair made me think she's broken this line going back hundreds of years. This is my sign that her and I, we can break this abuse that I went through. And that, as silly as it sounds, her having red hair really helped me realize I could and I was strong enough to not repeat my mother's abuse. And my mother was actually here when I gave birth, because she normally lives in Europe. She wasn't supposed to be here around the time I was giving birth. They were supposed to visit in May, and I gave birth in March, but they decided to change their trip without warning or asking, because that's my mother. And I remember she wanted to come see the baby at the hospital, and I was unsure. I was very hesitant. But then I decided I want to give her a chance at being a grandmother, because there have been stories of abusive parents turning into loving grandparents. So she came to visit me at the hospital the next day, and she was holding my daughter. And I started hearing some of those key sentences from her, those small bits of manipulation, stuff like, oh, it's a good thing you don't look like your dad. And that made me think, okay, she's repeating with her what she did with me, and I can't let that happen. And that was another one of those moments I realized I'm not my mom. Because my mom wouldn't have reacted that way. My mom never protected me. And I believe as a parent, your job is to protect your child. And even now, my daughter's 7 months old. And my mom keeps saying, oh, I hope the world reopens and I can come visit you in March. And I keep saying, yep, we'll see how things go. And I know if the world does reopen, I don't want her to visit us in March for my daughter's first birthday. I want my dad to come visit us. I want Ben's parents to visit us. I want my friends from home to visit us, but I know I don't want my mom here, and I know I'll put my foot down to protect my daughter from her. But I've noticed even just myself as a parent, I'm not at all like my mom. Like, as I mentioned with the dog, the parenting technique that we use is completely different. Obviously, my mom's parenting technique was manipulate and control, and what we're using is called RAI. So it's respectful parenting. So it's teaching my daughter how to be respectful by showing her respect at all times. So like with my mom, if I was doing something bad, she'd smack my hand and tell me to shut it or whatever. Whereas with my daughter, if she's doing something we don't want her to do, like today she was playing with my glasses, and I'd say, Rowena, I can see you want to play with my glasses, but you're not being very safe with them. If you're not going to be safe, I'm going to have to take them away from you. And so then she continued not being safe because she's 7 months old and doesn't realize she can poke herself in the eye. And so I'd say, I've already warned you. If you're not going to be safe, I have to take them away from you. I'm taking the glasses away now. And I've noticed that's a complete opposite of what my mom would do. My mom would just grab things out of my hand and not explain, whereas I'll explain first before I even touch her. So I'd like to think that we've broken the cycle. And I think she's the reason I broke the cycle. Like, Rowena's the reason, because of her hair. As silly as that sounds, it's her hair.
And honestly, you know, little things like that, whether it's a superstition or it literally, like, you know, as you explained it, it broke this tradition that really existed. You know, it's okay to believe in that. And it sounds like, you know, from even just those few examples, that you are a great mom and Rowena is very lucky to have you. So I commend you, on working all of that out.
Thank you. That's very nice to hear.
So we are high up on time in terms of recording. So I'm going to, with all of my guests, I ask like a fun last question that's completely random. So I am going to segue into that before we close it out here. My question for you today is, what is your favorite kind of drink? That could be alcoholic, that could be a type of coffee, whatever it is, any choice.
Huh, that's a very good question. I'm trying to think. Completely pulling a blank. It's 12:30. My brain is asleep. my favorite type of drink. Ooh, there was a restaurant we used to go to with Ben in Brussels, and they served once at the end of the meal for free, because we went there a lot and we were friends with one of the servers, a shot of like cinnamon flavored rum. And I haven't had it since, but that was a really, really good drink. And it was just obviously just a shot, but it was really nice. And like the cinnamon taste, I love rum anyway, so I'd probably say like, yes, cinnamon spiced rum.
Cool. I made you think on that one. So it's always
fun. Yep, definitely.
All right, that brings this episode to a close. There will be lots of information in the description, and we want to say something to the listeners, just that if you are ever going through something that, you know, might not be safe, is a bit unknown, you have questions, you're concerned, you know, reach out to someone. There are so many resources out there. The internet is your friend in finding them. Obviously, since Jess is in Australia, like, most of her resources are there, but we encourage you to reach out to someone. On a brighter note, if you want to connect more with Jess, she has a podcast and a YouTube channel. Her YouTube channel is called Story Diver. She releases a couple episodes a week, and one of them is always Hunger Games related. So if you are a fan of that book series, definitely go check her out. And she also has a podcast as well, which prior to this episode we recorded, I recorded for her. Her podcast is called RSV Pod, and she talks to different people each episode about their commitment story. So if you want to hear more about me and my boyfriend, go over and take a listen there. It will be out a little bit later in the week if you are listening to this episode the day that it does come out. If you would like to connect with my podcast here on social media, links are in the description, including the email. We are on Instagram, Facebook, and Patreon for support as well. And thank you to Jess so much for spending time with me today, and to my listeners for taking the time out of your day to hear a new story. Until next week, bye.
Bye.